program. But this whole story started off with a report that came out of AIMS, the Atlantic Institute of Market Studies, and it was to examine or look at, and I know that Paige McPherson, who is now with the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, wrote this for AIMS, wrote a story about this through AIMS, and there's also been other articles written. Marco Navarro-Gini is joining us on the broadcast this afternoon. Marco, thank you again for being available to us.
Not at all. Thank you.
And, well, TroyMedia.com, School Choice, a Good First Step to Quality Education in Atlantic Canada. This was an article that was written recently by Matthew Lau. I don't know. Have you read this, Marco?
Yes, I have. Matthew is one of our writers.
Now, in some ways, the question I'm putting out there is that, well, why is there pushback even talking about charter schools? Why do you think that is, Marco?
It is no surprise that among labor unions and teachers unions, the idea of charter schools has always had, pardon the pun, a frosty idea, a frosty reception. Mm. But I think the fundamental issue is unions, and you can't blame them for it, look after their own. And in Alberta, for example, the biggest fault that one can find from the union perspective is that teachers at charter schools are not full members of the union and therefore not full contributors to the coffers of the union. But, you know, the evidence that we found, as you might recall, is that over the last couple of decades, it's a pretty long experiment in Alberta, charter schools have outperformed on the average all schools, really, whether public schools and private schools. So they do offer essentially the same availability to great extent that one would get for a regular public school without having to pay extra and for a much better outcome if your child is in that school. The proof is in the pudding in the sense that there are thousands of people lining up at the doors of many of these schools in wait lists, waiting for a spot for their children. Hmm. And so, you know, if that is any indication, parents know which way is up.
Marco Navarro-Gini is here as CEO, is that correct, of Atlantic Institute of Market Studies?
That's correct, yes.
Just again, to take some of the words that Grant Frost put down on paper, or I printed off, once open, these schools draw students and the associated per-student funding away from public schools. Their parents tend to be some of the more engaged, so essentially what happens is the rich kids go to the charter while the poor kids stay in the public school. He's quoting, I think, a number of people involved with the charter school system in the United States when he brings that conclusion forward. Do you feel that that's a point, that there's some reflection of reality in that?
To some extent, but let's first be very careful about comparing the United States to Canada. Canada is not the United States. The United States is Canada. Tonight, we're going to witness something that doesn't happen in Canada, for example. You know, all that hatred. We don't have that stuff. The idea that it draws resources away from public school is kind of a red herring, considering that charter schools in Canada, the Alberta version, are public schools. They're the exact same thing as a public school. The only thing that they have is a kind of a top-up in the program. So people who go to a charter school, they can choose. For example, there is one in Alberta that has emphasis on Mandarin and Cantonese language. There's another one that has emphasis on sports and outdoorsy things. And there's another one that has an emphasis on music. So the idea here is that different children learn in different ways. Hmm. And if you are in a regular public school, but say you're an outdoorsy kid, you might not want to get up in the morning to go to school all the time. But if you go to a school where the majority of the children have a similar interest and they're outdoorsy and you're doing what you like, you might get up to go to school with a little bit of a spring on your heel. This is one of the reasons, for example, that accounts for the better outcomes. Whether, for example, they come from rich kids or not. Let's be careful here, because more engaged parents does not necessarily equate to richer parents. That's another red herring. There are plenty of people who are from modest incomes and even below the poverty line who have a committed interest in the education of their children. And if there is any reward in that sense for the child, is that, that their parents would be actively engaged in the education of their child. But income necessarily does not translate into interest or the other way around. I've told you, I can tell you because I used to teach, that sometimes their richest children are the ones that are most wanting for attention from their parents.
We've got Marco Navarro-Gini here joining us. He's with Atlantic Institute for Market Studies. Let's go back to Matthew Lau's story recently. And Canadians experience the enormous economic benefits of competition daily. Those are his words. For most consumer goods, over time, Canadians pay less, we get more. Businesses compete to offer customers the best products at lower prices. Those with offerings that consumers judge unsatisfactory are even eventually forced to go out of business. As long as there's competition, consumers are the kings. Marco, I get that when we're talking cell phones or internet service, tires, or even, you know, restaurant meals. But we seem to, as a society, draw the line with healthcare and, by the looks of it, education. When we talk about whether there should or should not be competition. Is that a product of the universality, the fact that we as Canadians expect that doesn't matter where you live, whatever postal code you're in, you should get the same health care, you should get the same education?
Yeah, I mean, I get the idea that, you know, we should all get, and nobody gets the same, really, because the moment you have two different doctors, it's not the same.
Yeah.
But comparatively speaking, you know, we want to have people who receive similar services, similar care, and whatnot. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. But when it comes to education, the nature of education is that not everybody is equal in ability, not everybody is equal in capacity. And so what we are trying to do is make everybody the same in an activity that essentially is designed by nature to bring out the best in people. And so if we go for the, you know, lowest common denominator, that means we are essentially acting against the very nature of the activity. Imagine, for example, a hockey league in which we strived not to have the children excel, but which we just wanted all of them mediocre. We wouldn't stand for that, and we wouldn't accept to have an Olympic team go into the Olympics in hockey, for example, with that kind of attitude. We want our children in these hockey programs to excel to the best of their physical and mental ability. There's nothing wrong with that. So the teachers who keep telling us that we have to make all their pupils the same are essentially acting against the very nature of the activity of education.
Marco Navarro-Gini is here. I think there's a concern that turning students into commodities, that having education per student available to groups that are perhaps taking students out of that public system that we described as the neighborhood schools, the system we know today. That some people are worried, Marco, that Ames is interested in trying to somehow leverage or make money off of education.
Well, that's nonsense because we are a not-for-profit and B, we are a charity. We don't make any money off of any of these things. The idea that we want to turn children into a commodity is exactly the opposite. We want the children to have the best possible educational options. People who want all the children to be the same are using the children as a political football, which essentially is a commodity or a thing for their own political purposes. And that's wrong.
Well, some would also say, competition is great, but people aren't always happy with the way elections work, and we usually have choices there. Marco Navarro-Gini is here. You talked about being a not-for-profit at the Atlantic Institute of Market Studies. I'm sure you've been tagged in the same story that I had, pressprogress.ca, the group behind Steve Bannon's Toronto event, also funds Canada's biggest right-wing think tanks. It's talking about this group. I'm not sure if I'm saying the name correctly, but Aurea Foundation, the report that this group did suggests that Atlantic Institute for Market Studies received somewhere in the order of $252,500 between 2011 and 2017. Does this relationship exist?
No, that would be incorrect. I think there is a measure of truth in the sense that we have received money from Aurea in the past, but 2017 was just last year. We did not receive money from Aurea last year. We did not receive money from Aurea the year before. And if the implication is that this study comes out of that money, well, that's simply untrue because the study was published this year and we haven't seen Aurea bucks for a few years.
Does Oria hold influencer sway over Ames?
Absolutely not. That's not the model. I mean, we don't do fee-for-service research, whether it's private or foundational. There is essentially a wall, if you will, a firewall between the money and the research. We at the Institute decide what we research, and we don't prejudge the outcomes. The people who we contract or are expected, as we ourselves are, to go where the evidence leads. We don't prejudge the thing. And people who donate money to us, and there are many people who donate money to us, we'd like for there to be more, do not have any say whatsoever in the outcome of our research or in what we decide to research.
We have obviously a lot of information about Ames. If you go to the website, it talks about independent economic and social policy think tank, and a number of the folks who are involved are listed on the website. Marco, you agreed to come on the show, not knowing that I was going to ask you about that. I think you probably suspected I would. And given the conversation, when we, again, full circle, go back to this whole issue about charter schools, what would have to happen in order to convince people perhaps outside of the teachers' union or others involved with that part of the system, that this is a good idea?
I think the fundamental issue, Sheldon, is variety. There are, I think, we intuitively know, whether we have children or not, that all kids, and all human beings for that matter, are different, have different tastes, learn in different ways, and come to information and come to things in a different way. So what we are essentially promoting, if we are promoting anything, is a system of education that accounts for this basic building block in human nature, which is that we are, in that sense, different because different things appeal to us. And so if what we're saying necessarily comes to this, that different kinds of education, different pitches, if you will result in children learning better and achieving greater outcomes, who can stand against that?
Marco, I thank you for being available, for answering the questions, and clearly this is not the end of this conversation.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Take care.